Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you a recording from a recent event at the centre titled Global Solutions. Are international organisations up to the challenge of providing global public goods for development? Presentation slides from this event are available on our website, devpolicy.anu.edu.au.
My name's Robin Davies. I'm the Associate Director of the Development Policy Centre here at the Crawford School. I'll introduce our three speakers in more detail before each of them speaks. I'd just like to begin with a little bit of context, but before I do so, I should also acknowledge and celebrate the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet and pay our respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. Now, for some context, the sort of general topic of the discussion today is common challenges. The quasi-technical term is global public goods, but we're essentially talking about common challenges that are important for development, but they're challenges that affect all of us. So we're talking about infectious diseases, we're talking about global financial instability, we're talking about environmental degradation and climate change, and a range of other issues of that nature. Now, back in about 1999, the notion of global public goods came onto the radar and generated a lot of discussion that continued for about 6 or 7 years from that time. There was a seminal publication from UNDP, Inga Call and some other people wrote a book on global public goods, which started the discussion, and the concept sort of took off for a while, and it was everywhere for a few years. Despite the fact that now, that episode is largely forgotten by people who work on aid policy. But at the time, the concept of global public goods was seen as a very useful tool for thinking about the implications of globalisation for development, for developing countries. And it was seen as a way of emphasising that there was a whole range of issues that were underfunded. We're not getting enough attention, we're not getting enough funding, including all of those things that I mentioned. So essentially there was a lot of noise in this area for a number of years. And then, interestingly, around 2007, this all just evaporated. People largely stopped talking about global public goods. But that didn't stop donors quietly funding more and more activities in this area. And in fact, as part of some work I'm doing with Warren, we've looked at the trends in aid flows for programs that broadly in this category. And up to about 2000, 2002, funding for global public goods had doubled within aid programs, within global ODA. Since that time, over the last 10 years to about 2011, funding again has doubled for global public goods. The numbers are pretty rubbery, but the trends are quite clear. And it's not surprising when you look at what's happened in terms of the creation of new multilateral funds and programs, particularly in the health and the environment area over the last decade, that you would be seeing this sort of increase. So you've got this very interesting situation. People stopped talking about global public goods, but they kept increasing the share of their aid programs that were used for these purposes, even while they had an aid policy narrative that was very much about supporting national development priorities, very country-oriented, not talking about global challenges for the most part, unless it's in relation to things like vaccination, where most of the action is very concrete and country-level. So interesting sort of history there. And on top of all that, in the last few years, there's been a few other things going on. You've seen the rise of new donors. The emerging economies are really becoming significant donors now. And they're beginning to increasingly occupy that sort of country-oriented space that traditional OECD donors say that they occupy. So, there's a bit of competition going on there. You've also seen a significant shift in the geography of poverty. You've got more and more of the world's poor living in middle-income countries, or what comes to the same thing, you've got more and more low-income countries graduating to middle-income country status. And this is putting pressure on the traditional narrative around aid. Can you maintain the position that aid is primarily about reducing poverty in poor countries by supporting national development priorities when your customer base is dwindling, And in fact, you are quietly spending more and more of your money on global public goods. So I think in the very near future, you'll see the concept of global public goods come back to the fore. You'll see an increasing emphasis on the use of aid to address common challenges, challenges that affect all of us. Right? Now, if you accept that, then the focus, the spotlight immediately turns toward international organisations. If you're going to provide global public goods, for the most part, you need international cooperation. There's not many of these public goods that can be provided by individual actors. And most of that international cooperation has to be mediated by international organisations. So it's fine to say, you know, we should be giving greater attention to global public goods, spending more money in this area, but are the international organisations that mediate this cooperation really up to the task? And my final remark is that, you know, there are good reasons for thinking that many of them are currently not up to the task. If you look at what they're doing in this area, it tends to be fragmented, it tends to be quite donor-driven. It's often marginal to their core operations. We might hear a bit about that from Warren in relation to the World Bank. And it's not conducted on the basis of clear institutional strategies, either within single institutions or across multilateral organisations generally. So that's why today we've focused this discussion on the role of international organisations in providing global public goods. I think it's very topical. And it kind of helps that we have three extremely engaging and experienced speakers to talk to us about these issues from three complementary angles. We have an hour and a half all up, or now a little bit less, given we've started slightly late. The plan is that each of our speakers will talk for around 20 minutes, and we'll try and allow at least 20 minutes or so at the end for a question and answer session. So I think that's all from me, and we'll begin with Warren Evans. And just to say a couple of words about Warren, some of you will have seen his bio, but he recently retired from the World Bank, where he was Sector Director for the Environment and Climate Change, and also had a long career at the Asian Development Bank before that. Warren was instrumental in setting up the Climate Investment Funds as one of his major final acts over the last couple of years. And in the year up to his retirement, was engaged in a substantial study on precisely the issues that I've been talking about, and I've been working with Warren on those issues. So the study is provisionally titled Collective Solutions 2025, but you can have some champagne if you give us a better title. So I'll turn over to Warren now, and I'll introduce the other two speakers as we go along.
Thanks very much. Great to be here and have an opportunity to talk about some work that we've been focused on over the last year and a half, just a little bit in regards to the genesis of that work. I've been involved in environment and development my entire career, 25 years in Asia and the last 10 years at the World Bank, more on a global agenda. And during that time, a lot of things, as is the case in all issues in life, there things seem to go in sine waves. But one of the issues that I became very concerned about the last since about 2006, 2007, has been a what I consider an imbalance, or potential imbalance between the issues of directly addressing poverty reduction at the country level versus some of the global issues that Robin, regional and global issues that Robin talked about on the part of the World Bank and other multilateral development banks and largely bilateral assistance agencies as well. So let me just explain that for a second. As you all know, after about 1998-99, after the financial crisis, there was a strong shift in focus towards poverty reduction. We started doing poverty reduction strategies. There was a very strong shift of the OECD members on country-owned, country-driven development assistance, which is all great. And in fact, most will say that most analyses show that there's been great progress on poverty reduction across the globe. And I personally believe that's true. The issue that I have with that, and particularly the issue that I have with the way the World Bank and others are now operating, is that because we are so country-focused and because we are so country-driven, we don't have a real strong balance on looking at longer-term regional and global issues. Most of what we do, most of what countries need for poverty reduction are somewhat short-term actions. And increasingly, we are not only dealing with poverty reduction at the country level, but we're dealing with crisis after crisis, whether it's a climate event or a financial crisis or a food price crisis, whatever it is, we spend a lot of our time as development workers dealing with Monday morning fires. And those don't necessarily have a long-term impact on the sustainability of economic growth or social growth at the country level, but they are issues that need to be dealt with, and that's just a reality. I'm going to skip through some slides here fairly quickly, but that's the background. Is there a potential role for the World Bank and other multilateral development banks to take on, in addition to, not instead of, but in addition to local, short-term, country-driven poverty reduction and economic growth, the regional and global long-term issues that Robin talked about? And that's what started the study. First off, just some quick maps, and I know that this is the world turned upside down, but bear with me, this is what it looks like in most of the media, unless you're down here. To me, this is not the world. To me, the world is depicted better if you look at consumption and production issues. Population obviously is important. You guys shrink very quickly when you start looking at this. GDP is very important in terms of wealth and consumption and production. Energy consumption. Very quickly, if you start looking at these kinds of presentations, you see that sub-Saharan Africa almost disappears. Many of your many Asian neighbors become pretty small. The developing world becomes very small when you look at energy consumption, greenhouse gas emissions, to a certain extent. But in this one, you start seeing India, China, and so on growing. But the point is that these are, if you're looking at the sustainability of development, when we start looking at global public goods issues, all of a sudden these are what counts, not the standard geography. And when you're in an institution like the World Bank, or if you're engaged in international negotiations, like many of you probably are, one of the issues that I think is very important is to remember where the problems arise, who benefits from the delivery of global public goods, who's not benefiting, who's generating global public bads, who's suffering from those global public bads. And I think this is for greenhouse gases, and I'll talk quite a bit about climate change because I think that's the big ticket item. You know, when it comes to where is the problem from, here's high income, here's middle income countries, these are the low income countries. So and for middle-income countries, this is a nice breakdown of where those problems arise. I'm not trying to point at these countries so much as I am at the high-income countries, but more important is when you're talking about global public goods, it's this little slice here, the low-income countries that need these goods the most or need to avoid the bads the most, and they tend to be impacted the most by not having the goods or having the bads. And that's from a development perspective, if we're looking at the long-term issues around that an institution like the World Bank ought to be looking at, and the global community in general, it's really important to remember that. There's a set of four slides here, and four slides. When our book comes out, you can study this, but one of the issues that one of the questions that I have been asking for a long time, many of us have been asking, is what's the world doing about these kind of problems, these global issues? So way back in 48, and I come from the environment community, so I look at it most of that way, IUCN was established in 72. We had the Stockholm Conference, 92, the Rio Conference. And the Rio Conference kind of kicked off the the big show, the jamborees that followed. And I think the question that you have to ask is, if don't try and read this, but just look at the years. So 92, we had one. 96, there were four. And then it starts growing and growing, and each year, almost every year, there's more and more until you get to, I apologize, this slide didn't turn out quite right. You can't see it, but if you get to 2012, all of a sudden we're at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 11 international jamborees to deal with these global issues. And the question I ask is, what difference have they made? What difference are they making about dealing with the big issues that our future generations have to deal with, the issues that I consider our generation to have done a pretty god-awful job of dealing with? So what are those issues? Population growth clearly is a big issue. Urbanization within population growth is a major, major challenge for the coming 10, 15, 20, 25 years, and particularly in Asian developing countries, in sub-Saharan African countries. The urbanization agenda is going to be one of the greatest challenges mankind's ever seen, in my view. By 2025, we'll go from 48% of people living in cities to 64%, and that'll just keep going up. And again, most of those are going to be not in the mega cities. Most of them will be in small and medium-sized cities in developing countries. Economic growth will continue on. It may be in a slump right now, but many of the developing countries will continue to enjoy that growth. And what will that result in? That'll result in a very large new middle-income class with disposable income that's going to want to consume the same way that countries like mine have enjoyed. So, you know, not just refrigerators and air conditioners, but sushi and you know, good tuna, good red wine, and so on. Who blames them? I like that stuff. They're going to want that too. The problem is there's going to be an extra 600 million or so people that have that capability to buy that stuff in developing countries, particularly in emerging incomes now. And most of them are going to be in cities. So the disposable income, the increased population, the consumption patterns that we're going to see in the future are daunting. And when it comes to issues like at the global level, like food, water, and so on, those all compound the problems that we're starting to understand will hit us pretty soon. In the meantime, what I consider, I used to call climate change the elephant in the room. I don't anymore. I consider it the woolly mammoth in the room. It's a hell of a lot bigger than an elephant, and it's gone extinct. And that I think is important to consider. When you start looking at issues like the realities of the impacts of climate change, and I think the publication that the Potsdam Climate Institute did for us at the World Bank, there's two of these now, the four-degree world reports, turn down the heat reports. I encourage everybody to look at these. They're really worth looking at if you want to lose sleep at night. It's frightening. The impacts of climate change are absolutely daunting, and the impacts of climate change on all the other global issues that Robin mentioned, the GPG type issues, is huge. So the water agenda, the food agenda, the fuel agenda, the urban agenda, which I consider a global public good issue now. And by the way, I'm not too interested in debates on what's global public good and what's not, but it's a global issue. Climate change is going to have just a massive impact on all of those. Severe weather events will go up. 35% of sub-Saharan land that's arable now will not be arable under a four-degree future. I'm not going to go through all these 200 million new refugees. We're already seeing a number of impacts, like the flood in Thailand recently cost 4% of the GDP. That's huge. That's a huge loss of GDP. Increase in fragile states. One of the things that we looked at in the work we've been doing is some of the new work around security and conflict and migration issues. All of these are exacerbated. They're all problems today. They're going to be a whole lot bigger problems, more difficult to deal with in the future because of climate change. The problem is that through the international discussions that we have today, based on current commitments in the UNFCCC, the negotiations, We'll have, with the current commitments, there's a 20% likelihood we'll exceed 4 degrees by 2100. This is in a political environment that somehow thinks we're going to stay at 2 degrees. And that, to me, is just silly thinking. It's just wishful thinking. The reality is that based on current commitments, we'll be at probably hit 4 degrees or be close to that. And if the pledges that are not met, we could hit a 4-degree world by 2060. And nobody really knows what that means. I'm not going to go into this very much. But some of the things that we are concerned about that we see today as major, major issues, water, the loss of ecosystems and ecosystem services, the whole food security agenda. Nobody really understands yet what going beyond a 2-degree world. We kind of have a feel for what a 2-degree world would mean for these issues. A little better, a little worse feel, but some feel for what a 3-degree world means. There's really no solid understanding at all of what a 4-degree world will mean for these issues. And so for a global public goods agenda, this is huge. Now, one of the questions that I ask is what will actually make the world get together? And I think that Patrick's going to talk a little bit about this on the governance side. But what will cause the world to come together and actually deal with some of these issues? What will help push institutions like the World Bank to have a stronger focus on some of these issues? I'm not a big believer in the current processes simply because I've been around and seen what's going on. This is a graph that one of my colleagues put together of the number of meetings per year on climate change. These are major international meetings starting from 92 to 2012. And you know, if there was any kind of progress accompanying that on dealing with the issues, I would say, great, this is an investment worth making. But the problem is I just don't see this resulting in a whole lot of impact. And so the question is, how will you generate that impact? And that this is about climate change, but you could have similar graphics on biodiversity conservation. You could have similar graphics on a whole lot of the global public goods issues. They wouldn't be as dramatic, but they basically, you could come up with the same kind of analysis. Many of you that maybe read Mad Magazine as a kid like I did will remember Alfred E. Newman, What Me Worry. And I put this up because this is mainly geared for discussions that I have with college kids, but I put this up because there has been a tendency to think that, you know, someday technology and international agreements and so on, somehow those are going to save the day. And that was sort of the way Alfred E. Newman looked at things. He said, you know, why should I worry? Someday somebody's going to take care of this. And then there are lots of quotes about somebody not doing anything somewhere every day. And so I think this is, you know, to hope that technology, to hope that solutions will arise without a change in international governance and without a change in the focus on this is a little bit wishful thinking. There is, and Robin mentioned this already, there is a trend towards looking at GPGs or financing GPGs through ODA, through development assistance. But even though that has gone on the rise, the question that ought to be asked is it near enough to have the kind of impact that's required? And I think the clear answer is no. In an institution like the World Bank, we do a lot on climate change. We do a lot on biodiversity conservation. Probably the biggest financiers in those two areas of any international organization in the world. But the problem is that's all other people's money. That's all, aid money basically moving from bilateral to multilateral systems, which is great. I think we do a pretty good job with the money we get. But what is being invested from the institution itself, from the capital that institutions like the World Bank and ADB sit on into these global issues? And the answer is practically zero. Why? Because we are owned by a bunch of countries, and those countries particularly on the recipient side, want that money to be going into those developing countries for those country programs. And so it's very difficult to shift money away from the country programs into regional and global programs that deal with the kind of issues we're talking about. So there's this is a real big challenge that I see in the near and long term to see whether there can be a better balance between the country focus and the regional and global focus, where we put our own balance sheet to work on some of the regional and global issues. That's not happening right now. At the same time, in my view, if it doesn't happen, then the relevance of the work of the multilateral development banks, and I'm not just picking on the World Bank here, will go down fairly quickly. And the reason is the amount of money that comes from multilateral development finance institutions like the World Bank is increasing, it's a drop in the bucket today. You know, it's that drop's getting smaller and smaller and smaller relative to some of the new donors that Robin was talking about, relative to, in particular, foreign direct investment. So in the future, we've got to figure out how to use those limited resources to have a greater impact. The amount of money that's required is huge. All the aid in the world is not going to touch the need. And so the other thing that has to happen is to figure out how to really use that money differently. 10, 15 years from now, in my view, we should not be doing projects in developing countries. We have to basically figure out how to leverage public sector money, aid money, to much more effectively mobilize institutional money from sovereign funds, pension funds, and others, and mobilize private sector investments in the kinds of developments that are required in these countries, and make sure that the additional funding is available to make it climate resilient and low carbon. Will the Green Climate Fund save the day? I worked on the Green Climate Fund design. I think it has great potential. It's not going to save the day. It's not going to mobilize the kinds of resources in the best of worlds that are required to deal with these issues. I think that ODA will play an important role in the future, but that role has to change. And governments have to become much less risk-averse, unfortunately, with their taxpayers' money, to make sure that they actually can help leverage that public sector money to mobilize the kind of private money into financing real sustainable development. Skip this. It's not simple. It's complex. What I'm talking about. There are a lot of actors that have to be brought together. Just a few of the basic conclusions to wrap up here. First, ODA is going to change. It is going to become, even if it increases in volume, it's pretty flat in real terms now, and probably will go down in my view, partly because of competition for other sorts of finance. It's going to have to look different in the future. It's going to have to be used to mobilize private resources in a very, very different way than it's being used now. International organizations are going to need to not only deal with local issues, but also think about long-term global issues if they're going to have much impact beyond the very local level. We do have a role to play in global public goods. We need to be selective, meaning the multilateral development finance institutions. We need to be very selective in what we take on. But issues like climate change, we've shown that it makes a lot of sense for us to be in that game. And we need to, as I mentioned, we need to figure out how to bring together, how to mobilize private money. Just a final point that I wanted to make is that one of the challenges I see for all development assistance organizations is that we are very short-term in our outlook. We've got to figure out how to become more long-term. We do, and I pick agriculture as an example here. We're all still looking at agriculture programs that are 5, maybe 10 years on the outside. We ought to be looking at agriculture strategies that are 50 years. We ought to be putting R&D in place that's really changing agriculture so that it can become sustainable. One of my favorite pet pushes is perennial polycultures. So we move from doing annual crops to perennials, which can be done. But there's very little resources going into that. We've got to really start thinking much longer term and much more regionally and globally, and then start driving short-term programs to try and achieve long-term objectives. And I don't see that happening in the world. It's going to mean new kinds of partnerships, a lot of South-South, a lot of South-North, but a lot of work between sovereigns and non-sovereigns. This isn't just about countries anymore. It's about cities. It's about NGOs, civil society. It's about foundations like Gates and so on. So I see a very dramatic change in the makeup of the partners that go drive these programs in the future. And I believe they will be very much by like-minded partners coming together, as opposed to what we, and I'm not saying we shouldn't follow the UN processes, but I don't think those are adequate to deal with the kind of challenges that we've got. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Warren. Now to introduce James Moody. Many of you will know him from TV, but he has many, many qualifications to his name. So I met James when he was, I think, Executive Director, Government and International at CSIRO, but he also has a range of responsibilities in relation to the World Economic Forum, and was Executive Secretary of the Millennium Projects Task Force on Science, Technology and Innovation back in 2005. So eminently suited to talk about research and innovation, which of course is a very significant cross-cutting global public good. James, over to you.
Well, thank you, Robin, and good afternoon, everybody. It's a real honour and a pleasure to be here today. I'm going to take you through this topic. Actually, from my background, is actually in innovation. It's not really in development. But one of the things I realised, particularly as we were doing this work in the Millennium Project Task Force, the work that I used to do with UNEP, is that there's a lot of similarities between the two. One of the most important similarities is that for innovation, as for development and in fact the multilateral system, institutions are one of the most important determinants, one of the most important factors between success and failure. In fact, institutions and infrastructure in the innovation space. And both of those, when you strip them right back, are actually collective action problems. They're all questions around how do we work together. You can't have single actors doing things alone. It's actually how do we pull ourselves together. So what I'm going to talk to you about now for my brief time here is a couple of thoughts about why we're in a very interesting point in time at the moment around the issue of both global public goods but also development and innovation. And then what that might actually mean to a couple of institutions and a couple of domains in particular. So without further ado, the first thought I want to share with you, and this is something that that I've done a lot of work in, is actually about this notion of that we're in a very interesting period at the moment. We're in this 5-year period from the global financial crisis onwards is we're actually witnessing a change from one wave of innovation, as it's called, to another. Ever since the Industrial Revolution, 200 years ago, we've witnessed what they call these five Kondratiev waves. The first one was around milling. We then gone to railways, then around electrification, then mass production and information and communications. And if you actually dig into those, and this is a bit of work that was done by Allianz a while ago, here's the Industrial Revolution. We didn't actually have a stock exchange. These numbers here, this is effectively the S&P 500 index. So this is a proxy for how the world economy looked for the last 200 years. So here's the Industrial Revolution. Off we go. There we go, the railways. You've got the electrification. There's World War I. There's World War II, followed by the Great Depression. Off we go. Here's the 1970s oil shocks. And what you can see, for the last 30 years, believe it or not, it's actually been pretty good until we got to the GFC. That was 35 years of growth. Even if when you got to the dot-com bust, you know, it was still growing. It just didn't grow quite as much, and we all got quite shocked. And often what happens in these waves of innovation is we overreact when we get to the peak, and that makes the trough often deeper. So the first thought I actually want to leave with you is that basically we are in a transition point. It may sometimes feel difficult and, you know, and it's often very messy between these waves of innovation, but we're in a transition point. And at those transition points are fascinating because it's often at those points when a lot of assumptions, a lot of the things that we hold true no longer apply. And I'll dig into that a bit more when I start talking about the global environmental commons. And indeed, Warren's already started to talk about that. The second thought, and this is also a little bit taken from innovation theory that I'm sort of starting to apply into the development space, is this thought that lasting change occurs when problems become opportunities. If you think about the life cycle of a lot of changes, often they do start off as problems. They start off and actually framed in the problem space. So one interesting one is women's rights. You think of the suffragettes. You think of, you know, there was a whole lot of issues. There was a big issue around women getting the right to vote. There was a whole lot of things. World War One came along and some things changed, but World War Two came along and suddenly what was a problem, women's rights, suddenly got reframed as women's participation in the workforce. It was an opportunity. And in fact, there was, if you really start to look at the history of some of that change, a lot of it has its roots in that world, in that suddenly the reframing, not necessarily, you know, of course it takes a long time for these changes to roll out, but actually that reframing. A really interesting one I heard about recently was in Sydney. They had a big problem with late night crime. It was all to do with folk coming out, you know, the pubs and the nightclubs were shut down. Folk would come out, get into brawls. There was a lot of violence, a lot of rowdiness. Some clever person actually decided, well, why don't we change that around? Why don't we call it the late night economy? And we could start to see if we invested in the amount of money that they're now pouring into what they're calling is the late night economy. They realised that the late night economy was worth $15 billion for Sydney. If they could just get something for these folk who would otherwise be outside fighting to do. And again, this problem of crime, and it was actually, it all came from the crime problem space, suddenly turned into the opportunity problem space, and a huge amount of money got poured into it. So if I add those two thoughts together, you know, that one, where we're actually witnessing a very interesting period of significant change, and the second is that basically if we really think about lasting change, it's when problems can sometimes be turned into opportunities. You start asking the question, what is the future for global public goods? Where do global multilateral institutions start to fit into it? Well, I'm gonna actually take a case study, you might say, something I know a little bit about, which is in the UNEP space. I used to sit on their, I used to chair their youth council for UNEP and still have engagement with them now and again. But interestingly, there was some investigation. UNEP, as many of you might know, has got universal membership now as a result of the meetings last year. And that actually gives pause to think about what is the future of UNEP. And as Warren already sort of started to say, you know, over the next 10 or 15 years, if we're really going to address some of the climate changes, some of the environmental issues, you know, it's not going to be just the multilateral system. It's not going to be just governments that do it by themselves. We actually have to start looking at sovereign funds, looking at, you know, beyond the traditional actors in this space. And as you start to pull that out, you realise that there's actually two UNEPs. There's one UNEP that's playing in the challenge space, the problem space, and there's another UNEP that's playing in the opportunity space. I characterise these, I'll call them UNEP 1.0 and UNEP 2.0, because actually UNEP 1.0 had been around for a long time and UNEP 2.0 is just starting to emerge. And you know, I won't go through all of these, but basically if you actually looked at the, in some cases, these two UNEPs are very, very different. You know, 1.0 was all about protect the commons. Great. You know, it actually did reasonably well in a lot of the global commonses that we've had. And it's actually quite a great space for multilaterals to play. But UNEP 2.0 is more about decoupling. It's actually about how do we create economic growth without resource consumption. You know, the assumption in UNEP 1.0 was actually we may not decouple. You know, we may not find a way of doing it. But actually, in 2.0, it's actually we are decoupling. Hey, let's accelerate it. Let's help people to do it. Justification, you can read there, you know, tragedy of common systems. You know, the different mechanisms are often quite separate. Sometimes it's about just displaying the science. And we're still seeing UNEP 1.0 doing this. It's transparency, it's, you know, treaties, regulation, league tables, whatever it might be. Whereas in UNEP 2.0, it's about signals and pricing, and you can read the others. And interestingly, even the approach is sometimes different. It's about government intervention when you're talking about the problem space. Right? When the opportunity space, it's actually often about government doing the complete opposite, setting some of the rules and then getting out of the way. You can dive in, the actors are different, you know, it's legal and judiciary and government versus entrepreneurs and civil society. The trends to pull is often, you know, it's the risk, oh no, we better do this or otherwise, you know, Chicken Little comes along. Whereas the other ones are resource efficiency, economic growth and so on. Even the scale is sometimes turned upside down. Sometimes it starts global in UNEP 1.0, translates down through local Agenda 21 or whatever it might be, as opposed to a space where sometimes starting in entrepreneurs and growing to global, and finally the drivers are different. And the reason why I put these two is you can actually start to see, and I'll ask some questions at the very end, can global multilateral institutions actually play both of these roles? Because sometimes even the skill sets or others can be quite at opposition to each other, the risk appetite and so on. The second sort of space where it's very interesting around where these two things start to interface is, you know, that the big changes we're seeing, as well as the fact that we may be shifting in some of these areas from a problem space to an opportunity space, is absolutely in the science and technology domain. And it's very curious, when you think about global public goods, some of the public goods that we don't necessarily think about how we're leveraging them properly is around knowledge and science and technology. There was the report that Robin's mentioned that I was involved in. I flicked through it again last night, and it's very interesting. It's still one of those great reports that did a lovely job of sitting on a shelf, but has had some input, but not nearly as much as I think it was. But interestingly, if you look at some of the recommendations that came out of it, one being here, infrastructure is actually the foundation of development. And interestingly, one of the things that we found out when we were going down that is actually infrastructure itself is not necessarily the most important bit. It's the problem of that you have when you have infrastructure, and turning that into an opportunity is quite important. So for example, you've got a piece of infrastructure, how do you maintain it? Now, clever countries, and you know, some of them that we identified, you know, so Malaysia, for example, actually realised that was a learning opportunity. Maintaining infrastructure became one of their, and focusing on infrastructure became one of their main ways in which they built science and technological capacity as a foundation for the economy, as opposed to the idea that, you know, okay, we'll build a bridge and let it go. Science and technology education, again, a real, you know, collective challenge. And how do you do that? There's a very big difference between the Oxbridge model, which, believe it or not, has been put into a lot of good parts of Africa, and versus the Polytechnic model, which then found its way into Asia. You can see a very big difference between those two areas. The importance of advice and standards. Again, Malaysia and Korea were very fascinating, the way they effectively leveraged their science organisations. They actually started off with standards. And again, standards became a way of learning, and standards created the institutions that they created in order to get quality, which they could then leverage to get growth. In fact, the Malaysian equivalent of CSIRO still sees itself as primarily a standards agency. It's called Serum, and it leverages that to go into some of the high quality science. Entrepreneurship, government procurement, all these different things, and then finally international participation. But what you can see from that space, interestingly, if you start to say, well, where does this fit into the global system? Where do these different issues? They're actually spread all over the place. In terms of how do we start to foster these areas? But at the same time, the problems that they might be addressing are quite significant, and Warren's actually done a great job of outlining a lot of these already. But if you actually think about these, the different areas where science and technology has a role to play, water, sanitation, so-and-so, climate, infectious disease, you know, they're quite huge. How do you go about turning them into the opportunity space? What does it look like? Well, interestingly, at the same time as we have all these large problems, and some of them are declining, and some of them are just increasing, the world has never seen so much information, so much knowledge in one place. Here's a list of, you might say, the global patent filings around the world. Now, if you think of this if you actually have a look at the global patent filings, if you can see the amount of knowledge that we've been generating has been growing. Now, interestingly, you think of the patent system. What is the patent system? It's very hard. It's a bargain. It's a bargain where, effectively, on one side, there's a trade-off that society decides it wants to make. We give a temporary monopoly over an idea in exchange for disclosure. And that's okay, and it's actually created a whole lot of value. You know, it often creates the incentive to invest a lot more money into the idea. But if you think about it, those ideas are not necessarily just going to be in the commercial domain. And what we're realising in that space is a concept called humanitarian licensing, or global responsibility licensing, or development use licensing, or equitable access licensing. There's quite a few names for it. But one of the things that's interesting is when you start to dig into intellectual property and the opportunities behind it, often there's three uses. You've got your commercial uses for ideas. You know, this could be rust resistance for wheat, in a particular a gene or whatever it might be. You've got your emerging market uses. In the health space, these are often called generics, where the pricing is different. And then you've got the bottom of the pyramid uses, the humanitarian uses, where indeed there's not there might not be a commercial imperative. And the fascinating thing about, you know, trying to separate those uses is you suddenly realise that there's opportunities to separate the application of intellectual property for those uses, protect the commercial space, maybe, you know, see this emerging market space as a way of, again, you know, finding extra ways of leveraging margin. But interestingly, humanitarian and the pro-poor uses start to emerge, and the imperatives become different. I mean, it doesn't cost anything to make those uses available, but at the same time, it might be great ways of getting market entry and indeed learning a lot about the technology, as a few of them does. Here's one example. This is a group in Harvard University that has actually done some work with an NGO called Diagnostics for All and the Gates Foundation, where they realised what we really needed was some, you know, if you're talking about healthcare in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, you need point-of-care diagnostics, which are cheap, don't need to be refrigerated, and, you know, effectively can give an immediate response, because the patient might, if you ask them to come back, they may never do so. So here's a technology which they then found. They basically managed to print liver tests onto a postage stamp size piece of paper. And that technology, which turns out, you know, it's got a very big development application, is now starting to influence commercial applications back. But the licensing that they did, the freeing up of the technology in that space, was actually done under humanitarian terms. Another good example is utilisation of waste streams, believe it or not, pineapple processing, you know, in Ghana. Again, TNO is the Danish version of CSIRO. And, you know, they were looking at how they could actually take more from that waste stream than otherwise would have done. And then finally, in the energy space, you can talk about WWF, again, partnerships between the not-for-profit sector and the for-profit sector, all about differentiating the uses of IP. The final thought about that, and it's very interesting, is that now some of the larger institutions are starting to take notice, and I think the shining light in this space is what's happened in the USPTO. They've actually just finished a program. They announced the winners, what they call Patents for Humanity, and in the same vein, they wanted to identify and incentivize areas where we could find humanitarian use licenses for existing technology. And so what the USPTO, the Patent Office, did was effectively gave, for the first time ever, an award and for these technologies. And the award was to accelerate a patent in any other part of the award winner's portfolio for those who can demonstrate humanitarian use licensing. In other words, it doesn't cost the USPTO anything. It just means that they move one person from the bottom of the list to the top of the list if they decide they want to use their certificate. But at the same time, if you're in the middle of a patent litigation, that can be extremely valuable to the recipients. And now the ones who won them, and it's interesting to see the sorts of companies who did win them, and the other ones who applied are the Microsofts, the Novartises, and some of the, you know, there's quite a few of them who actually see an incentive around making their intellectual property available for humanitarian uses, and the USPTO is currently investigating how they might want to expand that sort of program. So look, I guess for me, the sort of central message that I want to leave you with, particularly as we start to discuss, you know, change, you know, and this always happens if you think about post these, and I guess I do look at it from a wave of innovation, but post giant crises, giant changes, we often do sit down and rethink all of the institutions that are around, and for me, the interesting space for us to start to think about, and particularly when we're talking about global public goods and both unlocking global public goods for common benefit, but also protecting global public goods, is thinking about, well, is there spaces in the opportunity space? Because too often we discuss the problem space. That being said, there's not without a whole lot of difficult questions. Because I actually, I don't know, it's hard to well, you got it there. Can a lot of the global institutions actually work in both modes simultaneously. If you think about it, the stakeholders are often different, right? You think sometimes the stakeholders are the NGOs who make a lot of noise versus the NGOs who might be, versus business associations or whatever it might be. How do you work with both of those organisations at the same time? Can be done, but it's government liaison. It's really fascinating. You see one of UNEP's great strengths was that they had the environment minister in each country. Now, sometimes the environment minister in some countries is actually not on the same side of many debates as Treasury or innovation. So in the opportunity space, how does some of the multilateral organisations, are they talking to the right space? Some of the basic assumptions about what their purpose is, why are they there, might be different. The skill sets and even the language being used, the risk appetite, and I know Warren also raised this question, are we risk averse, are we precautionary, are we risk taking, are we trying to make, are we pushing the boundaries? And then finally, of course, there's the biggest question, and for any organisation, unless you have strong clarity of purpose, it's very hard to really reach great heights. And what does that mean as we start to evolve? So I hope that's been useful to you, and I'm looking forward to the discussion afterwards. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, James. And I realised I didn't attach any single title to James when I introduced him. That's because it's impossible to do so. However, what he didn't say is that quite recently he's the co-author of a book, The Sixth Wave, and I'm sure he would like you to buy it, so please Google it. Now, Pat Weller does have a single title, Professor of Government at Griffith University. Best known, I think, for his work on Australian politics, but in recent years has been venturing into the politics and the bureaucracy of international organisations. Which includes work on the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, FAO, WHO, and others. So I've invited Pat to speak to you about some of the emerging conclusions of that work, looking across all of those organizations. And over to you, Pat.
The interesting question we talk about international organizations, international governance, is the question was asked in the title of the seminar, are international organizations up to the challenge? And this is a question of the governance of international organizations, and I want to very briefly mention four or five of what you might refer to the challenges which they face at the moment, on the grounds that unless you recognize what the problems are, you're not actually going to get close to working out whether they can actually solve any particular problems. In many respects, the international organizations were set up with an architecture of the 1940s. Which assumed comparatively small membership and a comparatively inactive membership of many of the people who are going to be involved. So you assume there's a core group of people who are actually going to become heavily involved and a wider group which are going to participate but not in effect stand in the way of things getting done. And the membership has dramatically changed, of course, since their days in the 1940s as a combination of decolonization, the growth of nation states, the expansion of the number of states, and the extension of membership. So you went from a period when you had a real membership of 30 or 40 active states to a membership of 180 in many of the organizations. You go from a time when you had 30 or 40 who are active to 120 who are active. You go from a state where many of them were acting as individual states, which are now acting as a coalescent number of blocks. So that there are a whole groups of nations attached to most international organizations who are gathering together on issues of common interest to see if they can negotiate a common position. Now, in some places, like the World Bank and the IMF, where membership is graded by economy, GDP, and other things, so that in fact group membership, this can to some extent be reduced in terms of its impact. If you go to organizations like the World Trade Organization, which believes on the basis that everyone's in or nothing's decided, everyone agrees on consensus, and if you don't agree, any one country can effectively hold up many of the decisions. If you go to places in Geneva, where a small country is sending its national delegation consisting of two people to try and negotiate across 12 international organizations in Geneva and become sufficiently expert in all of those, which obviously they cannot do. then you start realizing the problems that participation has, and the problems of participation in many of the international organizations, as people move in and out across from one to another, trying to put their national interest, but also trying to talk to areas of common countries of common interest to work out what they can stand for. So participation in international organizations has dramatically changed in form, in content, and in amount over the last 20 or 30 years. And it's really interesting when you talk to people who are the ambassadors to these organizations about how much do you know, where do you get your information from, and to what extent can you fully participate in the activities of what goes on. And in Geneva, where I've been two or three times talking to ambassadors, there's a sort of delineation of what's important, the Human Rights Commission, which becomes a key body at which people want to talk, but which is about talking. And other areas where they have more technical knowledge required and they feel less capable of participating and they don't have the capital base backing capital that can actually assist them in doing it. So the first problem we have, I think, of international organizations is the massively increasing membership, a wider demand for participation without the commensurate skills necessarily to participate, but with an inability to come to decisions without that widespread support. The second matter of architecture which has changed was finance. The assumption when they were founded used to be that the assessed contributions coming from each country were going to be adequate to run the organizations, particularly some of those organizations which depend on funds, unlike the World Bank, for instance, which has its own bank amounts, own funds from which it can to some extent operate. The World Health Organization is now in a position that assessed contributions make up 22%. Of its annual income. So that 78% of its annual income has to be raised from other sources. What are the other sources? Well, it's a combination of tied funds and grants and trust funds that different countries are prepared to put up. But they all come with strings attached. They're saying, we will give you this trust fund if you spend it on such and such a topic, which not only, of course, alters the priorities of the World Health Organization, often inconsistently with what membership otherwise is saying. It also requires them to put an infrastructure together to support those new grants and those new positions. So increasingly in those organizations which cannot rely on assessed funds, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Health Organization, you're left in a position that the delivery of services gets skewed by the particular interests of the people who are prepared to give you trust funds or bilateral grants of one sort or other. Even the World Bank is in a position that trust funds make up an increasing amount of the money that comes in, and I think Warren suggested that much of the money that comes in on climate change is tied to the issue of climate change and nothing else. So the membership has to say, where do we stand in relation to trust funds? Do we accept them? Well, the answer is almost always yes. Do you accept them? And if so, how is this going to skew our own priorities, skew the own way in which we can actually run our particular activities? And then you have to get the permission of the membership. The interesting organization that we looked at was the World Intellectual Property Organization. Highly technical. It is 96% self-funding. Let's say 90%, 6% of its income comes from its exercise in registering patents on an international basis. It could be 100% self-funding, but the membership doesn't want that. The membership wants to give 4% of assessed contributions so that they can try and exercise 100% of control. So that although they can't stop the money coming in, they can actually stop the money going out. So there's an interesting contrast here between, yes, we know you've got the income, but you still have to get our approval before you actually try and go out and do things. So finance becomes an issue. Lots of donors, particularly private donors, will prefer to give money to something like the Global Fund, which they think has a much more directed target than international organizations, which they often see as not necessarily terribly efficient, and occasionally for good reason. A third question is the question of democracy in international organizations. International organizations represent states. That's their very basis for it. But increasingly people ask, Is there a democratic deficit? Are the people who are not being represented here somehow, even if they're not being represented through the, they are being represented through the states, but are they the people who are the recipients of the grants somehow being involved? And are all countries equally represented? It's really interesting to look at the methods of selection for leaders of international organizations. On the one hand, you have the World Bank, which has an electorate of one, the United States president. On the other hand, you could have the Food and Agriculture Organization, which has an electorate of 180 members. And by the way, the last Director General of the Food and Agriculture Organization was elected by 82 votes to 78. Every country is one vote. A person I know was traveling with the Director General some years ago of the Food and Agriculture Organization, and on his way to New Zealand, he took a sort of detour and went to, I think it was Nauru, for lunch. Well, it may be a long way to go for lunch, and he wondered why, and then he realised that there was a meeting of the Pacific Agriculture Meetings ministers on Nauru, and sitting round the table were 10 votes. He got re-elected. So when you actually have a democratic exercise, the question then becomes, what are the things which are taken into account? In the last exercise in the World Trade Organization, the comment was always, it's the term of Africa or South America. Other people have had their turn, now it's our turn to have a candidate. And eventually the South American, who was the ambassador from Brazil to the WTO, got elected. Although the vote was heavily divided, or was perceived to be divided between developed and non-developed countries, at least the view was, because they did it gradually, knocking people out on a sort of consensus basis, that the people who weren't going to vote for him would live with it. They could actually survive. So there was a choice there. But then you take the alternative, which is either the Food and Agriculture Organization, 78 to 82, which was actually quite a big margin compared to the World Intellectual Property Organization, where the vote was 41-40. Australia gets elected. It gets elected and seen to be the representative of developed countries. So a lot of the time then is spelt saying, how do we talk to the people who didn't vote for me? How do we talk to the ambassadors who voted for a Brazilian, actually, so that we can actually put them on the same agenda and develop an agenda with them, which actually pushes forward the mission of the organization itself? And often when it comes to these democratic elections, the person is less important than the place. And that can have some devastating consequences for the organization when you get some comparatively incompetent people who are elected to run the organizations. The fourth factor is NGOs. There used to be government organizations, there still are government organizations. The World Health Organization held an executive board meeting in January. There were 42 members of the executive board. Counting the people who were registered to attend, the total came to 940. These were not only the delegates from other states who were not currently members of the executive board and who wanted to be there to participate, it was also a very large number of non-government organizations. The World Bank used to sort of live without NGOs until the mid-90s, when there was a campaign about 50 years is enough. And suddenly Jim Wolferson thought it's at least better to have them inside the tent than outside the tent, and started involving them much more heavily. The World Health Organization has become much more heavily involved with donors from the pharmaceutical industry and from the Global Fund. It doesn't have the funds by itself. So those organizations, which used to be organizations of states with all the problems which I've already mentioned, now become organizations with a heavy component in discussion with non-government organizations, and that makes their life infinitely more complex. And the final thing to mention is, where should these organizations be? They're interesting contrast between the organizations which live at headquarters, the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, and those like the World Bank, the Food and Agriculture Organization, who actually have branches, the World Health Organization have branches spread all the way around the world. It's sort of, in the latter cases, it's really interesting, because when you visit the branch offices, the links that they have with the local government are incredibly extensive. You go to Indonesia and you talk to the country director there for the World Bank, and he's on the phone to the Ministry of Finance every day or so, and they ring up and get advice. By contrast, when you talk to the ones who are based in Washington or in Geneva, the contact with the countries may still be considerable, but it's not nearly as great. And the person I liked was a World Bank director, country director in a region where the time zones didn't fit. And he said, during the day, I speak on behalf of the World Bank to my country. In the evening, I speak on behalf of my country to the World Bank. And he does get the notion that if you actually attach to, in the capital cities, attached to the people, you get a different sort of idea about what is actually happening. Particularly for the bank, when we finished a book, we wrote a title saying that for the World Bank at least, the sum of the parts is greater than the whole. That what the World Bank does on an international basis, when you add up all the bits that it does in the countries, it seems much greater than the reputation of the World Bank itself. Now, these are continuing challenges for international organizations. The question is, what's the balance in influence? And that's what we are trying to get at in our study at the moment, which is, of course, going to conclude that it depends where you are and at which time, because there's no other way you can do it. But we're trying to identify some of the issues. There was a report written recently for the Pacific Island Forum. A report written by a person who had been in DFID, the British Foreign Aid Organization, and had spent 7 years in Rome as their representative to the FAO and the other agricultural organizations. And he concluded, he wrote in a paragraph, somebody wrote a book in Britain about who runs Britain. If you ask the same question about international organizations, any objective observer would answer the Secretariat. That would be a highly controversial answer, because the majority of the people who would be ambassadors think they run it, the people in capital cities think they run it, and the members back in the capitals dealing with them think they run it. The interesting question is, they all have some of the truth, they all have some influence on the outcomes, but unless we sort out the balance of who actually is doing what and the challenges which people face, make them determine on what it is that they want to achieve, for basically it's often a question of differential values that leads to the sort of inertia. Unless we sort those things out, international organizations will be organizations of great promise, but regrettably not great performance.
Thank you, Pat. So I think what we might do is have one round of questions. So we'll take three or four questions. Let's see what the demand is.
I'm John Scott from the Australian Risk Policy Institute. My question is directed to Warren Evans. I'm just wondering whether the language of global public goods is a bit outdated for the environment that we live in, given the huge amount of interconnectedness and interdependence that we face. My question then is, shouldn't we be talking much more closely and more effectively about systemic risks, such as the risk to the global food supply, the risk to local natural resources of countries, which are in some sense connected to providing that food, or whose land is being degraded and we're now outsourcing the farm. My sense here is that the purchase by individuals in donor countries is likely to be more direct if in fact we're dealing with their anxieties in sense of some of these things, as opposed to a language which is more dated and during an era when there was a lot more hope and optimism and a sense of we can do global good things.
Okay, thanks. Other questions? Yes.
I have a little bit of a concern about when institutions operate against other ones, right? And I'm thinking about institutions not just in terms of like a single body, but about the set of norms and practices that operate in an area. And the example I'm interested in is the ability to use science and technology to address global public goods because of the restrictions on the use of science and technology imposed by the WTO and WIPO and all the so-called free trade agreements that institute TRIPS plus agreements, right? So I'd be interested in some comments on that. I would just specifically like to disagree with James The patent bargain does not allow you to temporarily monopolize an idea. You cannot patent an idea. You can only patent the application of knowledge in an artifact or process. And the benefit to the community is not the publication of your rubbishy patent specification, given that 85% of what's granted is simply trivial and contains no new knowledge. It is the actual spillover benefit of those few granted patents that are hopefully the kind Sarah is applying for that genuinely have new knowledge in them. And it all comes back and gets complicated by these profit-making NGOs who now dominate so many of the forums, including particularly, for example, the pharmaceutical industry. So we've got, you know, all these different players fighting against each other, and the real issue is very rarely on the table.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm Nathan from the Crawford School. A very enjoyable discussion, thank you very much. I'm very interested in the extent to which the three of you, institutions that you all put a great store by, are actually themselves building up some capacities. The work I've been doing recently with Andrew Massey of the UK looks at the idea of what we call an appreciative capacity that has to be developed, along with an architectural building capacity, which is all about institutional design and creation. And the third, which comes through very clearly from what a lot of you have been saying, is the question of legitimation, the legitimation capacity, given that there's a lot of work now on private authority and global governance, and the extent to which is packed with the role of NGOs, and the extent to which they are, in a sense, authoritative, rather like the Weberian notion of authority, so that we have to pick up that. And underlying that, then, in terms of the capacity building issue, is the whole question of what I call institutional maturity. I think what's happening with a lot of these international organizations, like local organizations, is that they're only at first or second stage maturity. They're orderly shells or they're skillful instruments, but they're not living entities in any real sense. And I'm just interested from the three speakers to the extent to which, as I say, that capacity building is on the agenda if these institutions are going to be worthwhile, and the extent to which work is being done in relation to that life cycle issue of institutional maturity.
All right, thanks. We'll take one more question.
Thanks, Robin. Coming back to the definition of public goods, there's inherent in the whole notion is the idea of a consumer. The different definitions often don't really tease out the reality of who the consumer might be, but I think each of you has touched on it in different ways. At various times, the nation state is the consumer of the global public good, because the particular standard that might be set, the particular target that might be adhered to, becomes the global public good that countries need in order to work collectively. In other instances, policymakers writ large, NGOs, others all working together with a collective action problem, are effectively the consumers of what we're calling a global public good. And I agree completely, Pat. I think we have a failure of governance around understanding what's the nature of the public good, who are the actual consumer that we're trying to that needs to be able to consume it, and therefore what's the function and the management of that function, what does that need to look like, and then what does the governance, what's fit for purpose governance, really depends on what function you're trying to undertake at any one time. So I was interested in any of you thought that was a useful analysis.
Right, thanks, Beth. Now, maybe the most efficient way to do this is to just move along the table from James, and please respond to any or all of the four questions in less than 2 minutes each.
Look, they were awesome questions. I'd probably start with the last one, actually, first, because it is a really interesting question around, you know, what are these things and who are consuming them. I was reminded, actually, by a quote from Tom Friedman, who said, his quote is at the World Economic Forum after the GFC, said, we're doing to the global financial commons what we did to the global environmental commons. We privatised the profits, socialised the costs, and underestimated the risks. And it seems to me that there's an interesting space there. I think asking about who privatised, so it's interesting, I think there are different actors. Some groups are privatising the profits, you know, others are social, you know, and there's a whole other set, which is around your question around, you know, both legitimacy, maturity, you know, that I actually think that that is one of the fundamental issues we need to talk about. You know, the question around are institutions in their own right, you know, sometimes against each other? Absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, the harmonisation question, I think, comes down to the maturity space, is really important. It's not just harmonisation. The word institution is a terrible word, actually, because it means two things. And we keep on getting confused between the two things that it means. One is the people and the bricks and mortar and the thing itself. And the other one is the rules and the legal frameworks and so on that underlie it. And often I think we need to, you know, I know, when I worked at CSIRO was an institution. Well, yes, it is. But there's, you know, there's all these other things that you mean when you say institution. I think that notion of harmonisation comes down to both dimensions of that and making sure they're not doing it. We could talk for hours about patents, so there's no point really going into that too much, except that I'd just say that nothing's perfect. And I know the patent system has actually created a lot of benefits so far. And, yeah, it still has to evolve, but... you know, it'll get there. It's same as trademarks, same as all the other different forms of intellectual property. Each of them is a bargain in some way. I think that's probably... I might then leave it to Warren to answer the first question and we can go from there.
Yeah, thanks. On the first question, I actually think that global public goods is completely outdated. And when we started the work that we've been doing over the last 18 months... Robin introduced the idea of let's just lump everything in and call it international public goods. And there was tremendous pushback because there's a school of thought around this. And that's why, you know, I just tell people I'm not interested in debating what qualifies and what doesn't. So I think you're absolutely spot on. I would just add that and linking the discussion on institutions to that and on institutional maturity, that's a really good question, but... I actually, my response on institutions is, what would happen if the world was without? Mm. And there are a whole lot of institutions, whether you're talking about the bricks and mortar or the rules that drive something, that if they went away, there wouldn't be any difference. And I think that's really a critical question, but not very constructive, maybe. I think the question that ought to be asked is, do the institutions we have, using both of your the realms of institutions, do the institutions that we have, are they capable of dealing with the size, scale, and complexity of today and tomorrow's challenges? And I think it's pretty easy to come to a conclusion that the answer is no. And that's your systemic issue, is are we set up to deal with these? From whether you're talking about governance, whether you're talking about human capacity, whether you're talking about financial capacity, and across the board, the answer is generally no. And so, you know, we keep throwing what we can at the same problems and doing what we can, and we have lots and lots of successes. And if you add up all those successes, you come to failure. And that's what I think the world's got to be dealing with now, both on institutions and from my point of view, on finance.
Earlier this year, there was a meeting launching, I think, a paper on intellectual property and health. The speakers there were the Director General of the World Health Organization, the Director of the World Intellectual Property Organization, and the Director General of the World Trade Organization. It was a joint paper. And they all said completely different things. They all emphasize different points of this agreement because they all represent different communities out there. And in a sense, they were all fulfilling their obligations, which was to say, I'm interested in particular roles which my members require me to fulfill. Now, the fact that the members were the members of all three organizations means that the problems actually go back to the membership rather than to the organizations themselves. And it's not that surprising when you look at any single national government to know you don't have a common view on issues of patents and science and technology. Or on the notion of industry. The Secretariat of the World Health Organization proposed they should have a World Health Forum, rather like the World Food Forum they'd had in the FAO. And the people who sank it were the non-profit NGOs. And they sank it because they objected to the notion that the profit-making NGO should have any right to be at the table to put the point of view. So they would prefer to be left out rather than let the other ones come in.
So again, the tensions are not exclusively at government level, they're also in the competition which goes on below that level. On Ian's point about legitimation and change, I think it varies dramatically. Some organisations are really conscious about the need for changing their role, changing their structure, looking at new institutions. They all talk about change agents. Some of them actually take it quite seriously. And the legitimation is really quite important because of all the people out there, in a sense, who are their customers, if you like, but the people to whom they're trying to service. And you cannot get, I think, an international organisation unless you get the developed and the non-developed countries at least vaguely talking from the same page. And this is the tension which I think secretariats and leaders actually have to fulfil at the moment. And the NGOs and questions of governance also come on. I mean, these organisations are still state-represented organisations. That's their very nature. We can't get away from that. And there's always going to be, I think, a tension which exists between what the non-government organisation wants. The pingos and the bingos, as somebody put it. You know, the public interest and the business interest non-government organisations want. And what the members want. And eventually the secretariat has to report to the members so that eventually, you know, their particular problems leave us with question about whether or not they can actually face up to the problems. But at the moment, they can't do it, but can you imagine an organisation therefore that could, because it's going to have to be set up by the states.
Great, thank you. Perfect timekeeping. Now, if I had to sum up everything that these three people have said about the multilateral system, I'd just borrow one phrase from James. You know, nothing's perfect, but hopefully we'll get there. So please join with me in thanking us.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.